Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank, looking at money from every angle, leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show this Wednesday evening. A couple of interesting stories. Curo coming up with good results today. They had a strong trading update. Private education in South Africa has been a good sector to be in. And they've also now declared their first dividend, which is good news. We'll pick up on the Eskom story. Top writer on the public sector, Carol Payton, a Business Day standing by. We'll talk to her this evening. We'll also be looking for your real world stories this evening. I mean, I was just stunned today. I was in the back of an Uber and the Uber driver was explaining to me just how much less efficient he is during load shedding. And what should have been a half hour drive took an hour and a half. The guy didn't get paid as a result of the trip anymore because he hadn't covered any more distance. And he had greater wear and tear in his vehicle. He was stopping and starting and having to take alternative routes in order to try and minimize the duration of the journey, but it was an absolute shambles. So he lost out. I then had to use my spare time tweeting like a mad banshee from the passenger seat. And while I was doing that, my dentist called to cancel an appointment. And the dentist, part of a small practice that runs out of an old house, they haven't got the resources to go off grid. They don't charge like wounded buffalo. So, you know, you don't want them sort of incurring the cost of a generator, which they pass on to you. So then they postpone the booking. I mean, I look at this as a get-out-of-jail-free card, frankly. I've made my appointment for the year. I'll make another one next year. They lose out on the revenues. Large companies generally can cope with generators and with solar PV and all of that sort of stuff, and they can expense it over years. But they can't keep doing it in small business. I mean, Karen Richards today summing it up. She's a technical analyst on social media. And she's saying her dentist has had to spend 90,000 rand on a generator. And there was a consequence. They had to lay off one of their receptionists. And it's causing lots of bad temper. It's also very, very efficient. And people are rushing to do things and getting very angry and all sorts of stuff. So that is a key subject of tonight's Money Show. Plus, then coming up later on, Abel Sithole, who is the principal executive officer at the Government Employees Pension Fund. He is our shapeshifter. That's all coming up later on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Widespread havoc as a result of load shedding, traffic all over the place, a general sense of despair, the mood in the country taking a big fat nosedive as a result of just the lack of certainty as to when we're going to get some sort of stable power grid. Carol Payton, writer at large with Business Day on the line to us from Johannesburg. She is the top public sector writer in South Africa. And you just have been load shed, Carol Payton, but that will not silence you, not for a moment, I don't think.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Just load shed as well, busy filing my last story on Eskom.
Well, see, they tried to stop you, but I'm sure you got it through.
Yes, it went through, definitely.
You see, Eskom, you can't keep a good woman down. Now, listen, why is nobody but the people responsible for Eskom shocked and surprised at the fact that it is insolvent, that it is in a state of emergency? It's in a severe state of disrepair. Politicians this week reacting like this is something brand new, like it's 2008 all over again, and it's simply not.
Exactly. I think, you know, we've had these problems. And Eskom certainly itself has known about these problems. Eskom has been dealing with these problems. So the fact that they haven't reached the politicians' ears is somewhat surprising. Today, Pravin Gordhan was asked at Parliament, well, you know, how can the president possibly be surprised? And he said, well, you know, he thought actually the president was just expressing his despair. And I'm sure we all share that sentiment. I think there's a lot of despair at the moment.
There most certainly is. And the worst part of it is we simply don't know how deep the current trough is and when, if at all, a stable power supply is going to be recalibrated and reinstalled.
Exactly. And there were no promises made about that. And I think that, you know, the frightening thing about what is happening at Eskom at the moment is that the plant is randomly breaking. And, you know, while there are those people who claim that it's sabotage, I don't think that sabotage is the only explanation. I think the fact that, you know, Eskom cut its spending on maintenance by 50% over the The planters have been chased out. Incompetent people have been put into positions of authority, including running power stations themselves. And the new power stations that have been built are just not delivering the power they're supposed to. So I'm not definitively ruling out that there was a bit of sabotage here or there, but actually it makes perfect sense that the plants are breaking down at this rate.
I mean, the admission that neither Medupi nor Kusile was built properly, that they were inadequately designed, I mean, is a terrible and damning judgment on 10 years and, 400 billion rand down the toilet of failed electricity provision.
It is. And the really distressing thing is that, can they be fixed? Is it worth fixing them? What will it take to fix them? Will there ever be power stations that actually recoup what was spent on them? And I think that there are a lot of doubts about that at the moment. And, you know, all of this is happening just as, the entire world is moving away from coal-generated power. Renewable energy has become so much cheaper, and yet we're stuck building these two inefficient, badly designed power stations, when actually what we should be doing is moving as fast as we can towards renewable sources.
And there's no shortage of willing suppliers of renewable energy. They're queuing up and are eager to supply and to provide, but we've got a policy backlog, don't we?
You know, I think that it's not necessarily a policy backlog. It is a conundrum. So government desperately wants to fix Eskom because if it doesn't, it sits with this massive liability. So it hasn't come to the realization that you know, Eskom's old plant should be closed down as fast as they could, and you know, we should really make a decision on whether to continue, you know, what to do about these new ones. It hasn't reached that position yet. So I don't know if it's really a policy conundrum, but so much as a policy vacuum, as more as a conundrum as to, like, what to do next.
And it doesn't help that the ANC is sort of burning itself up from the inside. I mean, no sooner had the president outlined the plans, and these aren't new plans, these are plans that have been sort of on the table since, I think, 1999. I think you may have written that. That, you know, the talk of the breakup of Eskom is an old story. The president revitalized it in the State of the Nation address, and no sooner is the ink dry on his speech, but Ace Magashule is sitting in the Thule House going, no, we're not going to break up Eskom. You can't privatize like this, sounding more like Julius Malema than somebody who's on the president's team.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's just an indication of the sort of depth of the political problems that the ANC has, that the country has, because, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa might actually be trying to chart a way out of this thing by saying, okay, well, let's restructure and let's try and structure, you know, break the thing into three so that we can get a better grip on what's happening in the three parts. And then you've got people in, you know, of authority in his own party saying, oh, well, actually, this is a secret plot to privatize and we won't buy it. So we're in a very, very difficult situation as a country. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is due to, I mean, the problems at Eskom are absolutely due to state capture. They're due to Jacob Zuma. They're due to the fact that the ANC wouldn't get rid of Jacob Zuma. And now, you know, the fact that you've got ANC divided on this issue is just more of the same.
How damning is it that an organization, how many people does Eskom employ? 40,000?
40,000.
They're 40,000 people, and they're not sufficient experts, or one expert sufficiently qualified to dig Eskom out of the hole that it's created for itself. We need outside help. I mean, it was blatantly obvious that we needed outside help, but it's damning on Eskom and its management and its political management over the last decade that it's allowed itself to get into a position where it has to go and ask outsiders to resolve its problems.
Exactly, but I think we do have to remember who was running Eskom. I mean, the people who were running Eskom were Jacob Zuma cronies. That's who they were, and they were there to loot Eskom, not to run Eskom, not to provide energy security, not to do anything in the national interest, but to act specifically in their own interest. So that is what has been going on, and this is the consequence of that. And Pauline Gordon, he was very blunt today in Parliament, and he said, we're looking for engineers, and we've been phoning around the last 48 hours trying to find the old engineers from Eskom, and they're in Malaysia, and they're in Indonesia, and they're in the Philippines, and they've taken all of their skills and experience there.
It's a shocking thing. I mean, I've just got an SMS from somebody I know just saying our generator, this guy runs a factory, uses 1,200 rands worth of diesel per hour. It's a complete waste of money and time. When are you going to lay into Pravin Gordhan? He's been minister for a year now. Now it's a case of audits. And it's so interesting, isn't it, that Pravin Gordhan has been the minister in charge. He did, when he came into office, know that this was a burning issue. He did appoint a new board, did appoint new management, and yet we have to get to a breaking point, before we start doing what one would assume should have been done initially, which is a critical risk assessment.
I think so, and I think that, I think the mistake that was made by Pravin Gordhan, by Cyril Ramaphosa, and by even many of us, was to think that you put in new people at the top of Eskom, the new CEO, the new chairman of the board, you put those people in and Eskom starts running. But it actually doesn't start running. You've got 18 power stations dispersed all over the country, and that is where power is generated, and that is where the problems lie. So, in fact, I think what people are starting to realize is how important engineers are in this society. And we've completely forgotten about the engineers and how important the engineers are.
And these guys are sitting on foreign contracts now, probably absolutely in no mood to come to an organization that treated them like waste paper and tossed them onto the rubbish heap and said, well, off you go and fend for yourself. And so they have. And now we're saying, oh, by the way, please come back. I hope some do.
Yes. I hope they do too.
Carol Payton, thank you. Writer at large with Business Day has just managed to file her story, which I doubt you'll see on the front page of Business Day tomorrow. She managed to get it in the nick of time, just before Eskom pulled the plug on her area. The stories of people really struggling and people trying to run businesses and employ people and trying to keep people employed and not saying to people, sorry, you're going to have to go on half time because we're just not going to make the money and I won't be able to afford to pay you. There are going to be lots of those stories, and if we get this blooming thing sorted and sorted quickly.
The Money Show. The Markets.
I'm shocked at how many people are shocked at things that have shocked them. I mean, whether or not it was politicians being shocked over load shedding, whether it is retail shareholders being shocked at the fact that retail sales were down. I mean, the official retail sales numbers for December came out, and shock horror, they were terrible. But we knew this, Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. We knew this because virtually every single retailer that has reported a trading update over the last month has told us that December was an awful month, the worst in years.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. The one place you're not going to get shocked at the moment is my house. I believe we've got load shedding for the second time going on today.
Yeah.
That's the report back I've got from home.
Why you're here with us, you see.
The retail sales numbers today, Bruce, shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. And I don't think particularly were a surprise to anybody. If you see how the market reacted on the release of those numbers, you didn't see any particular currency reaction specific to the retail sales numbers. There's some other reasons why the currency's been weaker today. But as you point out, theoretically, the survey was expecting year-on-year retail sales growth of about 2.5%. It went backwards by about 1.5%. So a very substantial miss. But given the beat that we saw in November, which we attributed by and large to some bring forward of Christmas spend to take advantage of some of the Black Friday specials, and given the fact that these numbers are post-dating the trading updates of most of the retailers for the same period, it really was largely a foregone conclusion that these numbers were going to be substantially weaker than expected.
And they were. I mean, and then add to that, Hyprop getting a downgrade today from Moody's. Have they taken them to sub-investment? investment grade? I think they have.
Yeah, I think they went from BBB- to BB+, so sub-investment grade at high prop. And I think that's just an indication of how difficult it's going to be for the property REITs in South Africa this year, and specifically those with a large focus on retail. We've seen what's been happening at Edcon. Edcon, obviously, a very large tenant for a number of retail-focused mall operators. They've been getting some sort of concession, and as we mentioned, I think on a previous show, it's only a matter of time before some other tenants use that as an example and as an attempt, I guess, to use leverage and to get a better deal for themselves too.
Yeah, and that's going to put huge pressure across that entire sector. Curo, if we're looking for a silver lining, we'll take Curo. Thank you very much. Curo with a really good set of results out today, and also coming out with a dividend, which is something new.
Yeah, not too many companies out there growing earnings in the mid-20s, Bruce. They had indicated that that would be the case in a trading update a week or two back. But a solid set of numbers from Curo. Considering the environment, one can't really expect the uptake in private schooling to be quite what had been originally anticipated or what had been budgeted for the year, perhaps. But they've managed that pretty well. They've managed their capacity rollout quite well. They seem to be managing the potential for bad debts in this kind of environment quite well as well. So a good number from Curo. I feel a little sorry for them. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. They have paid their inaugural dividend. Remember, this has been a very capital-hungry company. They've raised capital on a couple of occasions in recent years. Confident sign that they feel that they can pay out a dividend. Nobody's going to buy Curo on the back of a dividend yield yet. Dividend's still pretty small. But that's a good sign. I did see at least two market commentators today criticizing them for paying a dividend, saying, well, is this a sign that Curo's running out of legs from a growth perspective? So damned if you do, damned if you don't.
I was going to ask you that question, though, because in this economic environment, and we've seen the likes of Advitech coming out with statements saying the waiting lists are shorter and shorter at the schools, blaming things like the economy and emigration of well-heeled clients taking kids out of school and taking them elsewhere. One wonders if they are going into a period of either much slower or even X growth.
Yeah, I have a son going into high school next year, so I've been doing the tour of the schools in the Cape Town region to look at the beauty parade, if you like. And if that's anything to go by, there's still plenty of demand for good schooling out there, more applicants than places, I think. So the Curo model, whilst cyclically it may be under a little bit of pressure right now, there's a long-term structural growth story that I think remains intact. If you look at their numbers, they're pointed to 57,000 students, I think, in January, up from 51,000 at the end of last year, and expecting that to grow further during the year. So the organic growth story, I think, remains live, and the structural growth story longer term very much remains live. There may be a cyclical slump where they don't quite hit the growth targets they'd originally anticipated in the short term, and as you indicate, with family budgets under pressure, they may start to experience small bad debt issues, but one would hope that most responsible parents will pay their school fees before they pay most things. But long term, I think this is still a business with legs, Bruce, and a proper long-term structural growth story.
EOH did come out with a further statement today. They came out yesterday to say that their loss of Microsoft reselling rights in South Africa was immaterial. It was only worth 10 million rand. The share price yesterday down 25-26%, down further today. And the company confirming there was a meeting, high-level meeting between the chief executive, Stephen Van Coller, and the Microsoft leadership. And both EOH and Microsoft aware of the urgency of this matter. Deliberations are priority. EOH is expecting a considered communication from Microsoft in due course. They still don't say why the contract was pulled, which is concerning.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly some sort of smoke there, and EOH do have an internal investigation, as I understand it, looking into these issues. Microsoft not happy about it, and I would imagine that Microsoft is a pretty key client from an EOH perspective. I know they indicate that from a revenue point of view it's not that significant, but I would imagine it's quite an important client of theirs, and they would like to to do everything they can in order to resolve this issue in a positive light, Bruce.
Chris Stewart with Investec Asset Management, tonight's market commentator on a day where the market went up 1%, 582 points to 54,543. Banks surprisingly strong, retailers falling sharply following those horrible retail sales numbers, but the real work today being done by anything with a Rand hedge element, whether it be Sappi or Sasol, Glencore or Anglos, Richemont, AB InBev or British American Tobacco, all up in the region of 3 to 6, 7% on the day. Good day for Rand Hedges.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Mark Lewis with sport coming up in just a moment. But on the next Money Show, the personal finance expert Warren Ingram. What happens to South Africans working abroad with SARS wanting to tax them at South African rates in those countries? The actual rule's not finalized yet, but they're due in 2020. You need to brace yourself. Also, loads of people already in breach of existing laws as things stand. Then small business guru Pavlo Fatidis, some sage business advice. Your questions, please get them in nice and early. All for the next Money Show.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
We're going to be looking at a new marketing campaign that Investec has launched. We'll also talk to Colin Cullis this evening about robocallers. I'll make some confessions. I think I'm in a confessing kind of mood as to my not great behavior when I get a call from a call center. But I don't like it when a robocaller, because I can't shout at the robot. Well, it can, but it's more mad than shouting at a human being. So I'll make a confession. I promise I will do that. We'll talk to the guys who created an app which has gone viral over the last 48 hours or so. We'll talk about that. And then the big five things you can do to cope with load shedding without blowing a fuse. I thought that was a good title for a discussion. But we'll talk to a psychiatrist, Professor Renata Skooman from Stellenbosch University, from the Stellenbosch Business School. And many of you may have been taught by Renata, and she is a big thinker on coping with stress, and particularly when you're sitting in traffic and you really don't know what to do next, and you've got the boss on the line or you've got staff on the line and all hell is breaking loose and you're just stranded because of load shedding. How do you calm down without losing it and blowing a fuse?
702. SMS Bruce on 31702.
Well, Investec have got what they're calling a new integrated marketing campaign to try and, I suppose, highlight the modern day complexities of life. And again, the digital disruption. I was in a fantastic conference this morning all about digital disruption in the banking sector. And they're huge steps forward. And it's, you know, because things are so incremental, you don't necessarily notice them happening on a day to day basis. But when you suddenly compare the way you bank today, for example, to the way you did 5 years ago and 10 years ago, you suddenly realize just how far we have come in this digital world. And you then start wondering whether or not there's a role for humans in that digital world. And the more you learn about the digital world, the more you learn about the importance of human connections, which is absolutely critical. And Lee Kasum has been to the launch of this campaign earlier today, Investec talking about privacy, data protection, huge number of investment options, and it gets very complicated and very cluttered. But Lee Kasumba, the host of Africa State of Mind, on the line to us. This is a marketing campaign. Is the zebra still breathing? Does the zebra still have a heartbeat? Are the zebra stripes still aligned? Put my mind at ease.
Yes, the zebra is still breathing and there is a heartbeat, but they have, interestingly enough, switched around the black and the white stripes so that it pops out a lot more. And they've
Pops.
Yeah, so it pops out a lot more. So the zebra is there. It just looks a little bit different, but it's the same zebra with the same heartbeat.
Excellent. Good news indeed. I mean, does it make the slightest bit of difference? I mean, whether the zebra pops or not to their clients?
I think, you know, if I were to think about it, I think it makes a difference because when they were talking about how they changed some of their branding, they had also tried to make the zebra look a lot more realistic. And because we are living in a world where everybody wants to feel as though things are a lot more real, and with AI and everything. So for their clients, I think that it did make a huge difference. But with regards to the brand campaign that they've just launched, Bruce, I was literally blown away because it's not so often that you'll find a bank that is really interested in ensuring that they're moving technology forward and they're offering the best to their clients, but they're also keeping the human element and the human connection in place, which is what I thought was really fascinating, because for Investec Bank, what they really kept pushing with this new brand, integrated brand campaign, was that it really was about having the heart of their people at the center of the business.
And nobody makes adverts anymore. People make brand films.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me about the brand film. Andy Rice is salivating at the prospect of this, no doubt. He's listening to every word. He's beside himself with excitement.
So the brand film was fantastic. They filmed it in Bulgaria, and sometimes, I think some nights they said it was like minus 14 degrees in the snow. So if you just think about that perspective, they looked all around the world trying to find the perfect director. Then they ended up with Tristan Holmes, who was a South African director, who was able to really capture the essence of what the script was. And then from a casting perspective, the lead protagonist was Nicholas Pinnock, who actually coincidentally has played a young Nelson Mandela in prison before. So it was great to be able to bring this entire global kind of space into this Investec brand film. And they filmed it in a studio in Bulgaria, which kind of looks like a world that we are familiar with, but a world that we perhaps have a kind of feel like, where do we find our place in that world, which is what we're finding a lot of people are feeling with technology. It's all exciting. The world is moving forward. But how do I find my place in the world so that the digital era doesn't take control of me as a human? And so with regards to the brand form, that's what you'll really be able to pick up from that.
Well, one got a sense in previous campaigns about different cultures within different parts of Investec. If it was a capital markets division, if it was the securities division, if it was an asset management division, you got a different sense of different divisions through the flavor of the marketing and the branding and the advertising. Is this an attempt to create a holistic Investec, a one Investec, if you like, view?
I think so. But firstly, I have to say, not just because I'm a woman, but the head of marketing, Danny Dixon, she was the reason why this time around they were able to do an entire holistic campaign that touched on all the different divisions within Investec. And also between her and her team and the agencies that they worked with, what they went around when they were pitching it to different divisions were talking about the fact that they wanted to be out of the ordinary. So for every single division, whether they were looking at people who were taking care of young professionals or people who had their businesses or people who had been with Investec for a much longer time, everybody wanted the same thing, and that was to be able to be out of the ordinary. So this brand campaign could speak across the board to all their clients, to all divisions, and that's what has made this one of the biggest ones that they have done to date.
Lee Kasumba, the host of Africa State of Mind, has been immersing herself in zebras. I'm glad the zebra's still there. And with the Investec new brand campaign, Investec looking for this holistic view of the big group as a whole.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Every now and again, there's a great idea that's simply ahead of its time, and sometimes they disappear off the face of the earth, sometimes they go dormant, and then suddenly they spring into action. And about 4 years ago, two guys developed a load shedding app, and it was the talk of the town. Nobody really subscribed to it, though. Nobody downloaded it. Nobody accessed it. And they won prizes in app competitions. They became famous for a while, and they did very well. On Monday morning, they had 2,500 subscribers. This morning, that had grown to 400,000. I then got to hear about them, and I, like many of you, I'm sure, also subscribed. Dan Wells is the co-founder of an app called Eskom Sapush. He's a co-founder on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. How many downloads have you had today, Dan?
Hi, Bruce. Good evening. We're probably at about 450,000 active users today. I'm not so sure what the numbers exactly, because it takes a little while for us to sort of, get that data. But we're definitely at about 450 active users just today.
And you were at 2,500 on Monday.
Yes, that's correct. Well, on Sunday, to be honest, because okay. Load shedding started on Sunday afternoon. But it's the nature of load shedding, and especially as a load shedding app. We have users when there are load shedding, and when there's no load shedding, we just have some people wondering what's going on with their power.
And so, I mean, when you developed the app, it was 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was more of a side hustle for you guys. I mean, you weren't looking to monetize it. You weren't looking to make big bucks out of it. It was more almost a curiosity project, if you like.
Absolutely. So Hadaman and I, we were working at the same company at the time, and we just wanted to create something to actually just let us know when there was load shedding, because we found the schedules quite difficult to understand. The Cape Town ones aren't too bad, but the rest of the country are very difficult to understand. So we created it back then just as a side project, and we were quite overwhelmed by the response back then. And then over the last couple of years, I've been keeping it running, and Hadaman as well, just for fun as a little bit of an experiment. And yes, December happened, where suddenly got a push notification that, or was it end of November, I think, that load shedding had started. And I honestly got a fright when that notification came through. I thought there was a bug in our code. So it was great to keep it running, you know, so that we can provide the service to South Africa.
Can you monetize it at all? I mean, I suppose because load shedding has been so sporadic and you haven't had the regular traffic, these sort of spikes aren't great for monetizing it. So do you just run it as a public service?
It's very much a public service. We only added adverts into the application last year. And we actually added adverts into the application last year as an experiment. We had, I think, about 20 users, to be honest, when we did that. And we did that as an experiment because we wanted to learn how the adverts worked in terms of monetizing applications. And now it's great to have. It's covering our hosting costs, and it allows us to scale out the application compared to 2015 when we had no income and we were sort of running it on our own.
When you look at the sort of traffic, you look at the desperation of South Africans trying to figure out what the load shedding schedules are. How did you manage to penetrate the load shedding schedules on a national basis the way you have as a result of and create this app?
A little bit of effort on my behalf and Hadaman's behalf in terms of capturing those different schedules so that we could present them in a common format across the app. So a little bit of effort to capture them, but something we did with pleasure.
And how then? I mean, do you tap into Eskom systems? How do you get the data to your app? Are they cooperative? Are they helpful?
We've reached out to a number of different municipalities, and including Eskom, but I don't think we have sort of the clout behind us to be able to find the right people to ask. So we've done a lot of manual data capture or scraping from our application, and then we store that on our system so that when the app users connect, they can get it even if those systems are down or those other websites are down.
Is web design, app design your day job, or do you do something far less exciting?
Well, both Hadaman and I, we work in e-commerce companies. I'm based in Cape Town, South Africa. I don't really want to mention the name of the company I work for, but because I do this in my own time. But we come from a history of working on banking applications. And now we both happen to be in e-commerce, but we work in the software engineering business.
And what's your next big idea?
We've got some ideas for the app because we get a lot of emails every day. So people saying our power's off. Do you know what's going on? Or load shedding, has suspended, but my power hasn't come back on. So we've got some ideas that we can put into the app. To try and, get a bit of a collaboration between different users. But, we're working on that at the moment. So something hopefully in the works.
Dan Wells, thanks for chatting to us this evening. The co-founder of an app called Eskom Sapush. You can find it in your app store. I downloaded it this morning. It seems to have been 100% accurate in my brief time that I've been playing with the app. And it's deadly simple to use. There's no complexity to it at all. And it gives you a much easier to read schedule of load shedding in the areas that you put in to the app. It's very smart.
702 Bruce is on Twitter @BruceBusiness.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. That's coming up after Eyewitness News now at 7 o'clock. And he's going to talk to us all about robocallers and how to navigate the robocallers, how to deal with the robocallers, what the robocallers mean in a world of aggressive product push. And then we've got Dr. Renata Schumann, the psychiatrist and leadership lecturer at Stellenbosch. The big five things you can do to cope with the infuriating notion of load shedding. And then the principal officer of the Government Employees Pension Fund, a man called Abel Setole, is our shapeshifter this evening. I'm looking forward to that discussion coming up in the next hour on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, the Government Employee Pension Fund, lined up like kids outside the headmaster's office. They look apprehensive. I like that. It's a good way to look when you come to the Money Show studios. I'm using myself into apoplexy. We get to have Colin Cullis in just a moment with Business Unusual, and then Abel Setole, who is the Government Employees Pension Fund Principal Executive Officer. Explain how it works. And he's got an interesting story. I mean, from the private sector into the public sector, and a very fraught environment. And we'll talk all about things like prescribed assets and all that sort of stuff that needs to be discussed this evening on The Money Show. Plus, how are you coping with load shedding? Colin Cullis is standing by, so we'll chat to him in just a moment. But if you've got some load shedding stories, are you finding innovative ways of getting around the vagaries of load shedding? Are you battle hardened? Are you toughened? Or are you just despondent about the fact that we're in the midst of yet another seemingly insurmountable? I don't think it is insurmountable. I'm sure the guys will get a handle on it. There's some very gifted people working and import the skills that we don't have, because those skills have been farmed out over the years, and get things back on track. But boy, it is quite debilitating sitting in traffic for an hour and a half when it shouldn't take you more than half an hour, for example. But some tough lessons being learned for South Africans time and time again. Business Unusual now, brought to you by SAP. Myths about SAP software have been busted. Keep listening to hear why the best run SAP. Wednesday night, and it means it's time for Colin Cullis and Business Unusual as always. I don't know how you react to the cold calls that you get from call centres. I have to admit, and I'm ashamed of it, that I'm not as polite as I could be. And I could be a nicer person about it. But what I have discovered is you seldom get a second call back if you are firm with the person who phones you. And I often will say to the person who calls me, I know this is not your fault. Feel free to block your ears, but this is for the tape. And then I leave a message for the call center operator. I leave a message for the company, because I'm on the opt-out list. And if you are, who runs the opt-out list, Colin Cullis?
Direct Marketing Association.
DMA. The DMA, or Direct Marketing Association of South Africa. I'm on the opt-out list. So if you are subscribed to the Direct Marketing Association and you phone me, you are breaking the law. So I tend to rant on about that. And I tend to talk for a couple of minutes so that I force them to listen to me talking at them. I'm sure by now they've wised up and don't anymore. But I get very, very grumpy with the cold call, because if I want to hear from you, I will ask you to contact me. Don't phone me unsolicited. It becomes a lot harder, however, when you answer a phone, you get, hello, I would like you to listen to me because I have something to offer you. It's not quite that bad, but it is robotic, Colin Cullis. These blighters have found a way around me.
Yeah, long before we have to worry with RoboCop, the robocaller is going to be causing a much bigger problem.
If this is what RoboCop's going to be like, I'm going to shoot myself now.
Good. This is exactly why it's going to cross threads. It's not nice. It starts off being amazing. It doesn't stay that way. And unsolicited calls, there's no shortage of them in this country. But if we can use the US as a little bellwether for what could happen, then things are going to get a lot worse before they do start getting better. And I would love for us to get a little more come to terms with it. Given the time of the year, an extreme Valentine may even want to use one of these. Call all of the current romantic relationships and prospect all the other ones to keep the sort of fires burning. But that would be kind of crazy. So I want to try and look at this in terms of the good, the bad, ugly.
Oh, come on.
Had to be done. Although you give your age cheese away when you say that.
Cheese!
That forms, yes, in your head.
That, yes, is cheese. That is like gorgonzola.
It is indeed. But it is a good way to separate them out, because it's not to say that robocallers are inherently bad. they can be used for, just like everything else with technology. There's no, you know, either or. It depends. And two reasons, I think, in the next
I think they're all evil, personally, but that's just me. Convince me otherwise.
Well, it's safer to hold that view because you would at least be protected. But most of us go onto the internet believing it's all, you know, rainbows and unicorns. And those are the ones I'm most fearful for. And quite honestly, in an aging population that don't really haven't got to know the internet quite the way it can be, they're most at risk. So reason number one, we're going to see a lot more robocallers, I suspect, for the next little while, is there's an election coming. No better way to tell a lot of people about your mandate and why you should vote for you and whatever else than just auto-dialing a bunch of people.
Hello, this is Cyril Ramaphosa. Vote for me.
Yeah, you're either going to get a lot from one party or a lot of police calling you. Either way, that's your phone ringing quite a bit more than you expected it to. And the second is that, you know, there aren't that many. Well, there's lots of regulations, but the regulations like that don't call me list that you talked about. Fraudsters don't listen to regulations. No. So quite honestly, there's not much use in the current teeth that the regulations have. And there are so many ones involved in it. It's very, very hard to look at. So let's go through some of those. The good ones, I would say, are ones that are going to give you a call when you actually would need it. Banks, for example, when they see dodgy activity on your credit card, can ring you and say, can you please confirm that these were actual activities that you are aware of and meant to do? Now, one of the pluses about having a machine do that is that you're not going to have bank employees having to go and get access to records that otherwise typically banks would want to keep away from staff working at call centers. Number two is you could say, I have a very sensitive business and very large sort of allowances. As soon as any of that activity is detected, call me any time of the night or day. Machines have got no problem with that. And so you can respond to it very quickly.
Provided it's done in such a way, of course, that it doesn't seem like a sales call. Because the same bank that is contacting you to tell you, by the way, there's been some dodgy activity in your account, one, you've got to trust it is the bank. Two, you've got to know that it's not going to be another sales call wanting to sell you insurance or top up whatever it might be that on your banking. It's got to be really managed well because you've got to know that you can trust that this is the message from your bank and that it is not another sales call, that in fact this is in your best interest. And we're so overwhelmed by these calls, I wonder if it's a good thing.
So true that you mentioned that. So a bank or anybody looking to do this must make their customers aware that this is a service that they will use and the kind of protocol it follows. Typically, the bank's ones, they send you an SMS, then they follow that up a little while later with a phone call. The phone call identifies itself to say this is an automated message from XYZ Bank. It's looking to follow up on some credit card activity and they quote some things and then ask you to sort of verify who you are. That bit still is a little loose because they kind of say, if it's not you, please put down the phone. That's a bit light. But then by the same means, if you're entering information and you're willing to enter information into a robocall, I think that's very bad. So I see why banks aren't asking you to verify who you are, because all it takes is somebody using the same old script and just guess.
Correct.
So that is definitely problematic, but there is a good use for it at least. And the other one, and this is still a little bit coming in the future, but Google last year announced that it could, you know, when you ask the assistant, book me something, and not all of those bookings can be made digitally. Sometimes, you know, when you want to make a booking at a restaurant, they don't have an online booking system. Or in this case, wanting to book a hair appointment. And what they showed last year was that the Google assistant can place phone calls. Take a listen.
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd. Sure, give me 1 second. Mm-hmm. Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay, we have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay, what's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
Okay, perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Have a great day. Bye.
That is freaky.
That is.
That is so freaky.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my word.
Even the hesitations of the whole world.
Oh.
After the applause.
I've actually gone goosebumpy.
Justified, I think. And after people had that reaction, they then said, this is terrible.
It freaks me out.
Yeah. Google has said, when they deploy this, the machine will always first state to the person that's speaking to, I am a machine, you're not speaking to a real human, this is just a fancy, clever algorithm. So that's kind of good. But I can see the value of that for when you need to have things done.
I see the value, but my goodness,
Yeah, the potential for doing nasty things there is very big. The last one of the good ones I'll give are those nags to say, hey, listen, you're a little overdue with an account. Now, there's some that sound terrible, and there's ways of doing it quite nicely. Now, the plus side about getting a machine to do this is they're not going to get upset when you start chatting at it and tell them to get off your case and whatever else. They'll remain perfectly calm and simply say, okay, thank you, just informing you, and move on. And then do that as many times as needed rather than, you know, have to go for therapy.
I would no objection to that.
Yeah, so that would be the basis.
Yeah. Debt collecting. Yes, because if you owe money, you need to pay the money, and you deserve to be annoyed.
Well, and there's the flip side as well, and these are the nags to please invoice, because as the world becomes more and more dependent on freelancers, and freelancers are so invested and busy doing whatever it is they need to do, they tend to sort of forget about the stuff, he says. So there's a nice little nag. The companies can say, listen, everybody on our books by a certain time of the month or whatever else, just make sure they all just get a notification to say, Give us a holler. And again, when you're not reading your emails and doing everything else, well, a voice call might be the other one. Now we move to the bad ones. And these are certainly ones we know, but how robocallers can make them so much worse. And here's a little story from the US. So 2015, they put in some legislation to stop automatic dialing. So you couldn't use a machine to dial a phone number. They already had lots of people from call centers doing this. And the upshot was they effectively just had humans tapping furiously on a mouse to the numbers that had been loaded and would have been dialed anyway. The lobby groups who wanted to get rid of this and just spam lots more people came up with a very clever way, because the ruling said a machine with a capacity to auto-dial is not allowed. They said, huh, that sounds like a cell phone. So the US, you're effectively telling all cell phone users they may not use their cell phone to make a phone call. Gosh, the regulators thought. And in 2017, they had to suspend the rule while they had to rewrite it. Last year, according to reports from UMail, 48 billion robocalls were placed. There's about 450 million Americans. Yeah. That is an inordinate number of those calls. And most of them are not the ones that fall into the good category. They are definitely the bad and the ugly kind.
But I can block these guys, can't I?
You can try. So the first thing they want to do to try and do is this. They tell somebody to call you relentlessly. And eventually you pick up. And again, America's, you know, the classic baby boomers, those are the guys who are not that internet savvy. They're sort of advancing in years. They tend to be a little trusting, and they're the ones who get done. So just calling and spamming everybody is the first thing. The second thing they tend to do is, you know, it comes up looking like a number you don't understand or a block number, then you don't answer it. But they start looking like they're numbers from your neighborhood. Then you're not sure if it's somebody I know that I just don't know. Or, you know, yeah. you revert to thinking, okay, I'll pick up the call and see what I can do. But the notion of the bad ones is, rather than just being a, hi, I'm trying to sell you some insurance, do you want to, you know, listen to me further, where people again can upset and make the call center agents not happy, the thing would simply just state a deal. And if you like the deal, they ask you to press 1, and effectively you hand over to the call center a qualified lead. Somebody who's already said, sure, I'm interested in finding out what this is. Now, that for legitimate businesses is not bad, but when somebody's saying, you've just won a lottery, press this button to claim your prize, and say, oh, great, click, and on you go, that's not so good. The second one with regards to that, and this is a US one, you tell me if you think it'll work in South Africa, is they claim to be from the IRS, the US tax man, saying that you're late in a payment. Please press this button so you can make amends. Not sure if in South Africa too many people are going to be moved if SARS had to ring them necessarily and say, listen, you're a bit behind in your taxes and we need some money. But hey, that's one of the
I wonder about that. I mean, there's certain organizations that elicit a response. SARS may be one of those.
Well, any debt collections, I suppose, would have this effect. And this because includes the legitimate version.
And again, if it now is accepted in legal practice in South Africa that SARS said, we did contact him, he just didn't push 1 for accept, and now you're in court, buddy. That would be quite scary.
It appears, though, the US model, IRS, they've said, we're not going to call people because of the way this can be abused. So they'd rather say, look, if you get a call from anybody, it's not from us. Right. And maybe SARS would do the same thing. We're going to contact you by other means first, and then we'll make ourselves known to you, which is probably a good thing. Debt collectors, again, I hear you on saying people who owe money should pay, but you really can harass people. And the catch with, you know, real-life people debt collectors, you can ring and say, hey, that debt collector, or the debt you're trying to collect, it's a really old debt. It's been settled long ago. Or the guy who sort of hasn't paid his bill, he knew he wasn't going to pay his bill. He didn't give you his number. He gave you some made-up number. It happens to be mine. With a robocaller,
got you.
With a robocaller, you can't say anything. You're just going to get this harassed stuff coming at you until you go in somewhere and pay some bill to make it go away. And that's the kind of catch with it. So now we get to what can we do? Insofar as who's got the opportunity to do something, it's not America. They are really so unwilling sometimes to want to get involved in this thing that I think they're gonna suffer a lot more. The EU seems to be sort of leading the pack for saying, let's think about this, because it's not one thing. It's mobile phone operators, it's internet companies, it's companies who do intermediate stuff, it's people who have got access to databases, it's marketers, it's all sorts of things. And in South Africa, we've got a good range of those as well. The wireless Application Service Providers Association. We've got the National Consumer Commission. We've got the Information Protection Officer, the part of the poppy thing. We've got the Justice Department. I probably left out a couple, but they all have a role to play. And the difficulty is the coordination they need to get to make this work end to end.
No, but exactly. I mean, who do you complain to? They go, oh, no, it's not our problem. Phone this one. Computer says no.
Exactly. And the fraudsters and scammers rely on that, knowing that it's kind of hard and complicated. Now, if South Africa wants to get ahead of the so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution and reap the benefits, a good place to start is heading off the downsides. And this is a very big one. So, as an individual, don't answer those calls. There is some apps. One that's quite popular in South Africa is called Truecaller. I think for the most part, people can use it. I would advise against it if you've got lots of contacts on your phone or very sensitive contacts on your phone, because effectively the way it works is you share the list of numbers you have.
Because nothing's for nothing, right?
Nothing is for nothing. You can get a paid for version, to be fair, but it's not. It doesn't preclude you from having to give the numbers, because the way it works is it says if you share your numbers with them, then they can see who's dialing who. And the first time somebody spam calls somebody, I can say this is a bad call, and I share it back with the central database, and they let all the other phones know, hey, this is Bruce. Bruce has been flagged as a spammer, and I can decide not to take the call or take the call knowing that he is or isn't that. And it's uncanny sometimes how good these things are, and sometimes the labels other people have given to people's phone numbers when the thing actually calls. But for the most part, it's be mindful that the internet now is every bit as scary and wonderful as the real world. Stop thinking of it as this, everything is, you know, beds of roses and everybody's trustworthy. The people certainly aren't, and these days, neither are the robots.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, and a big warning to you not to treat the robots any differently to the way you treat people. Shout at them too.
The Money Show. The Big Five.
The Big Five brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century, keeping you close for 100 years. Visit worksmans.com. A different kind of Big Five this evening. We thought we would take a fresh look at the Big Five and just say, hold on a second, what is the thing that is bugging you most at the moment? And I have to assume, judging by your commentary on social media, also on our SMS line, it is all about Eskom. So what we've done is invited psychiatrist in private practice and associate professor in leadership at the Stellenbosch Business School, Dr. Renata Skuman, onto The Money Show for the Big Five things you can do to cope with load shedding so that you don't blow a fuse. I mean, we're a tetchy lot as it is, Renata. I mean, we have a short fuse as it is. And now something like load shedding, like it is protracted load shedding, really does run the risk of driving us over the edge.
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening, listeners. Yes, indeed. I think especially in the current fast-paced world where we are, anything that slows us down might just be that last little straw. And today I was thinking, trying to see the humor in the situation as well, which is one of the things I will touch on, is that maybe Eskom is the big bad wolf at this stage that's really huffing and puffing our houses down or our businesses down at the moment. But yeah, we do have some ideas for you to help to make this situation a bit more bearable.
And I mean, critically, it is, I suppose, if you are able to plan, in other words, if Eskom sticks to its load shedding schedule and your municipality sticks to the load shedding schedule and you don't have your local transformer blowing up, then you should be sort of starting off on the right foot. You can't do anything to stop the load shedding, but you can do your best to plan around it.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give you 5 tips, and I'm using the acronym PUFF, so to huff and to puff. So we will take PUFF as the letters for the tips. And the first one is indeed planning. And I think where we really are the advantage compared to a couple of years ago when we had load shedding is that now there's brilliant apps, and some of them are fairly humoristic names or names that I might not be able to repeat on air, but we do have apps. And that's the first step, is really to consult the apps, to look at the published schedules and check the time, and you can plan ahead. And this is just a general good life tip also, to plan your day ahead. And then when you plan, swap your times around. It doesn't matter if you have to swap maybe your gym time or your jogging time with your admin and computer time. And it's also not a crisis if you swap your braai evening with your cooking evening.
Yeah, if you bribe. and I suppose, as in life, if you're a Boy Scout or a Girl Guide, whatever it is that you were as a kid, be prepared was always the motto. And it's a case of, you know, we become, I suppose, complacent for, after so many years. I mean, 10 years ago, we might have bought the torches and the lamps and all of that sort of stuff. But the batteries have calcified and leaked and none of the stuff works anymore. You've almost got to keep it like a lifeboat on a ship, ensuring that your supplies and everything are up to speed and up to date.
Absolutely, and that's the second P of PAF is to prepare. Make sure that you charge your phones, your battery, your power packs, all lights, all solar lights. And then the other thing that's very important, plan the traffic and plan your route. If you know when there's going to be load shedding and the traffic light is not going to work, make an alternative plan in advance, because to be stuck then will just get you more impatient and more upset with other people that's driving in the same situation than you, and it's completely unnecessary then to work yourself up about it.
And we do get worked up and we do get frustrated about the lack of productivity. We get frustrated about the fact that we're in a country that really hasn't taken charge of a crisis that's been brewing for 10 years, that's been apparent for 15 years, it's been apparent for 10 years. And people get very despondent about the space that they're in. I mean, can they control the rage and the disappointment, in some case, downright despondency about being sort of trapped in an environment where nobody seems to have given enough of a damn to help you through it?
Yes. I'm thinking or reminded of a quote by the father of stress research. He's called Hans Selye, and he said stress is not what is killing us. It's our response to it. And maybe it's not load shedding that is killing us, but also our response to it. And we can really turn this time that could easily be seen as dead time or time of frustration, but to utilize the time for things that really can add quality to our life. Really making time then for yourself to be offline, literally, or to spend time with your family and have conversations. Or use it, if you have a charged light, use it to read or play games with your children that you never have time for, or make it a special occasion, eat by candlelight or even dry marshmallows.
Fun, you mean fun?
You won't necessarily have time.
Fun,
yes,
is so 90s.
Indeed. No, it is so crucial. And that's the one thing, if you just look at social media, that I think South Africans, always when people ask me what makes South Africans special, I think it's our ability to turn any bad situation into something humorous. And if you just looked at all the little video clips and the memes that was going around the past couple of days, again, in terms of load shedding, we really, really are brilliant at seeing the humor, even in bad situations.
And some of that does anger people who are on the edge. It really, I mean, you make a load shedding joke to the wrong person at the wrong time and they're liable to punch you in the mouth. I mean, that's when you've got to come to terms with that reality too, that there are people who are incredibly stressed and incredibly uptight, and not everybody's going to share necessarily your sense of humor at a particular moment in time, as my Twitter feed will attest to over the last 48 hours.
Absolutely, and even with a situation like even for us at the practice, our switchboard weren't working for a time. Now, for a patient in the need, that is a time of crisis. Yeah. And I think my poor receptionist thought, oh, I can have a breather, the phone is not ringing. So we definitely have different responses to the same situation. What is important to remember that when any of us are confronted with a difficult situation or with change, humans have four natural responses. And that is either a fight or flight reaction, or you can freeze and be paralyzed. But the thing that we can so easily fall into the trap of is flocking. And flocking means we are actually, it's like gossiping. You know, when someone is changing something at work and you start to make little groups and chit-chat about it, but it can create such a negative atmosphere. And I think we need to also be careful in this time with the load shedding that we flock and make each other more negative, where it's really becoming an atmosphere of negativity about the country, negativity in the day, everyone complaining about the load shedding, everyone posting negative things about load shedding. There's literally nothing we can do about it. So rather let's try to connect with people, maybe even turn it into an opportunity. I mean, we were so good in Cape Town specifically at realizing with how little water we can get by, why can't we change our lifestyle even in electricity? Now, I know some listeners will frown for this, but shouldn't this also be seen as an opportunity where we really can turn something into something more positive?
Don't flock. Well, I flocked a lot, but I won't flock. maybe the thing to do is to avoid things like social media, because they become the self-fulfilling echo chamber. It's the place where you go and vent your spleen, and then like-minded individuals tell you how right you are, and then you rage on even more. And actually, all you're doing is you're simply getting, I think, what's it, your cortisol levels elevated and pushing yourself one day closer to a heart attack at some point.
Absolutely. You make yourself just more stressed about the whole situation and negative and frustrated and feeling powerless because, well, literally, no pun intended. But yeah, it has a very powerful way. And then to think, is it really worth my emotional energy? Is it worthwhile getting so upset? Is it worthwhile ranting and raving on Facebook? It's not going to change a thing.
You're not suggesting, though, for a moment that we become complacent and accepting and become passive citizens. We can rant and rage a little bit, surely.
For sure we can. But it's good if you can get your message across with a sense of humor. I absolutely do not agree that we need to be complacent. I'm very well aware it's almost the end of the financial year. My accountant reminded me about the tax I need to pay. So then I do frown. But it's to have a balanced view on it, not being complacent, but not stressing yourself out to the detriment of your own health. Also, if you are angry, you will not be able to make a decent plan for load shedding because our brains shut down. We cannot think clearly. We cannot make creative plans. And in the end, you're going to rant and rave for 2.5 hours or be frustrated for 2.5 hours during load shedding, where actually you could have done other constructive things.
Great advice. Dr. Renata Schumann, thank you for joining us this evening. She is a psychiatrist in private practice and associate professor in leadership at Stellenbosch Business School.
Breathe. The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
Tonight's shapeshifter is the head of the Government Employees Pension Fund. His name is Abel Sitole. First met Abel many years ago when he was working at Metropolitan Asset Management. And then he went to Stellenbosch University. He had a bit of a meander through academia. What dragged you into the Government Employees Pension Fund snake pit?
Well, I think just starting from the fact that I was a manager of assets at Metropolitan, being the head of Metropolitan Asset Managers. And before that, of course, I had been involved with pension funds in one form or another, the biggest one being the principal executive officer, at the time, not principal executive officer, actually the CEO of the Eskom pension fund. So my association with Eskom at this point in time is probably not something I should be kind of disclosing. But my involvement in pension had been long. And before that, I was with a company called Southern Life.
They had a tall building in the middle of town.
Yes, yeah. I worked in that very tall building. Okay. And
that was bought by First Rand and then folded.
No. It was actually bought first by Momentum. That was before Momentum joined up with First Rand.
Right, got you.
Yeah, and so there I was involved with negotiated benefit funds when they started. So the whole move from defined benefits to defined contributions.
You're starting to speak a language that very few people understand, and that is the language of insurance.
Yeah.
What got you into the world of pensions? I mean, I appreciate older people working in pensions, but young people, what's the excitement?
Well, the same thing that actually ended up having me at the university, a strong interest in the future and how to influence, prepare for it. And of course, insurance, by and large, is actually about that, especially pensions and especially defined benefit pensions. It's really about saying, how do you look at a mechanism to what we call distributor income over a lifetime.
And in the olden days, everybody worked in a large corporation would have been on what is called a defined benefit fund.
Yes.
You contribute, you retire, you know the amount of money you're going to get for the rest of your life, and you had a company underwrite that guarantee.
Yes.
Except eventually there are more people who are ex-employees than are current employees. There's not enough money coming in the front door to go out the back door. and a lot of these defined benefit funds ended up going bust, and as a result, people were left high and dry. And so the move then to defined contribution funds, which is what most of us outside of the public sector in South Africa are on, you contribute and contribute and contribute, you could contribute an absolute blooming fortune and be guaranteed absolutely nothing one day if markets fall in a heap.
Yeah, it is difficult to say that it is almost a foregone conclusion that your defined benefit fund at some stage will not be able to meet benefits if it's been looked after properly. Sure. And the actuaries have done the assumptions that they make in arriving at balancing the assets and liabilities. Actually, you should not have a situation where your liabilities actually are more than your assets. So that's it's about really balancing the equation properly, and that's where the actuaries actually excel in doing some of that work.
And I suppose the role of the actuary has changed over time as life expectancies have changed and medical aids have become useful in helping people extend their lives and live longer and healthier lives too. Suddenly you've got a bigger pot of pensioners. I mean, that's what you would face, I suppose, in the government employees' pension.
And that is really the significant change that in a sense was the death knell of defined benefit fund. It's a change in life expectancy, which the actuaries had not for kind of expected and it had not foreseen. And therefore, you had a significant growth in liabilities that exceeded the assets. And therefore, this mismatch arose.
You talk about the death knell of defined benefit funds, yet the government employees pension fund is precisely that. It is the best pension fund in the world. It guarantees you money for the rest of your life, underpinned by a state guarantee.
That is true. It is one of the few remaining defined benefit funds in the country. But the majority of funds have now moved to defined benefit. There are a few remnants of defined benefit, but the biggest one, of course, is the government's employee pension fund. Globally, there still are some defined benefit funds, although most of them are closed to new members and still are looking after old members.
Doesn't that make the government employees pension fund a dinosaur? Doesn't it make it obsolete? Doesn't it almost make you working yourselves into obsolescence? The rest of the world has seen the light and we haven't.
Funny enough, the real conversation in the world is turning around to saying,
perhaps we should go back there.
Exactly, and not necessarily in the old form, but actually acknowledging that there actually is something that is very, very valuable in a defined benefit, which I think in your definition of what the issues around defined contribution might be, that actually you might contribute for many, many years.
It's frightening.
And then end up with nothing. So that I think is something that in the world, there's the conversation around, so how do we deal with that?
And maybe you could do defined benefit, be less generous perhaps than previously as you make these things more sustainable over time.
Yeah. Or if you want to have sustainable defined contributions is to start inject some of the actuarial work that actuaries do to trying to manage the issues around defined contribution. Or I think one of the biggest challenges, especially in South Africa about defined contribution, is not so much the fact that the pot might be affected by markets, but the fact that the contributions into the defined contribution funds themselves are not sufficient. So needing to contribute more is quite important. And of course, managing the pot sustainably is also quite important.
And we need to talk about some of the thorny issues, of course, the relationship between the Public Investment Corporation, which has got a smell around it right now, the Government Employees Pension Fund, who manages the money within the Government Employees Pension Fund, how much latitude there is. Abel Sithole, Principal Executive Officer at the Government Employees Pension Fund. Just have a listen to this. Master of Arts, Stellenbosch. Master of Philosophy, Stellenbosch. Master of Business Administration, Wits. Master of Arts in Mathematics in English at Lawrence University, certified financial planner, professorial development program at the university. If I keep reading his CV, we're never going to get to anything. Chairperson of the V&A Waterfront, really? Is that as a result of the Government Employees Pension Fund investment?
No,
with growth
actually, point? I was the chairman of the V&A long before I became the GPF. Okay. I'm no longer. So when I was appointed the GPF, I resigned as chair of the V&A, but I was chair of the V&A, but I'm no longer.
We need to update the website.
Yeah.
That's what we do. But he's got a long and varied career, has Abel Sithole. More with him in a moment.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. The Money Show.
Shapeshifters. Abel Sitole is the principal officer at the Government Employees Pension Fund. Explain the link, the relationship between the GEPF and the PIC, the Public Investment Corporation.
The GEPF is a juristic entity. The pension fund is an entity like any other pension fund in South Africa. So it exists in its own right. And so as the principal, it's the entity that promises benefits and actually pays them. However, it doesn't do that by itself. It actually contracts agents to do some of the functions on its behalf in terms of administration and member service. The Government's Pensions Administration Agency, GPAA, that most members interact with that on a daily basis. And then on the investment side is the Public Investment Corporation, which is an asset manager. It's a corporation.
So you don't manage the assets yourselves.
No, we do not.
You give some of the money to the PIC, and some of the money does go into the private sector. I mean,
yes.
You've got a list of about 40 asset managers who will be given a couple of billion each to manage on behalf of government.
The GPF,
pension.
Yeah. So the PIC is an asset manager, although it is owned by government. Actually, it's registered in terms and actually complies with the FACE Act like any other asset manager in South Africa.
Who keeps an eye on your members' pensions? Because there have been some controversies around the Public Investment Corporation. IO Technologies has led to some suspensions and some evidence being led at the State Capture Commission and others. Real concerns about the integrity of the way in which the money is managed.
And I think coming out of the inquiry, indications are that there are indication that I think the concerns are founded, so that is understandable. But to answer your question about who watches it, it is the Board of Trustees through the Investment Committee, and of course some management, myself and the executives who are tasked on a day-to-day basis to be in touch with the service providers. But the more important thing is, of course, that there are mandates that are given to the PIC in terms of how they manage the money. So they're not managing the money in a vacuum. So we give them a very specific mandate about how they do, and then they take specific decisions. The one thing I want to emphasize is that while, and I'll come down to the issues around IO now, but I think we need to understand in the bigger context of what is actually happening. Over 70% of the GPF assets are actually listed in open markets. So in the JSE, both in equities and in the bond market.
It's the undisclosed bits that are interesting.
It's the undisclosed bits, but no. It's not undisclosed. The disclosed bits in the unlisted environment that are, I think, interesting. In terms of the proportion of that relative to the total of the GPF, it's actually around about 5% in totality. Yeah. And more specifically, even that 5%, it is not all the investments that are actually controversial. There are very, very good investments in that base. And then, of course, there are issues like the ones that now we're discovering, the IOs of this world, where there are question marks around those. But again, you need to look at it in context to say...
No, look, I mean, I'm not suggesting for a moment that the GEPF is under any threat of implosion, but there is an opportunity for a feeding frenzy if not everybody is watched like a bloomin' hawk all the time in the way in which money is invested, and you can't have friends helping friends.
That is true, and I think... So when I say 5%, I think I'm kind of maybe not giving the true impression, because that 5% is close to about 200 billion. So in terms of the quantum of the assets involved is huge.
Yeah.
So again, I think I just want to put that in context to say the 5% maybe that belies what is underlying.
Take me through the notion of prescribed funds. The more people I hear talking about prescribed funds and a prescription in the South African environment, which I think was started in the 1950s and sort of died a death towards the end of the 1980s, where asset managers and pension funds were forced to put more than half the money into government demarcated assets to bail out the government of the day, the National Party. We feel like we're on the cusp of doing that all over again, and it's not productive.
I think the experience, and again, sometimes in South Africa, we tend to operate as if we are unique, and the reality is that we are not. So as a pension fund or as investors, we are like investors throughout the whole world. And I think the experience... it is that prescribing how investors must invest is not in the best interest of investors. So I think...
Can investors be incentivized if say, Eskom decided to issue a bond with a 10% coupon or something along those lines, and government said, you know, you get a tax break on that. You might not get it all off tax, but, you know, if you, half your gain is tax-free over a period of 10 years. If you lend us the money for 10 years, when you cash it in, you get a great big tax kickback as a result of your expressing faith in the country and in the utility. Creative ways of encouraging people to voluntarily invest their money.
I think that's one way. And if you look at other investment markets like the US, for instance, municipal bonds, that's how they operate. They're basically giving very good tax incentives and returns. However, I think we must also correct what I think is not a correct notion that pension funds, including the GPF, are not investing. Actually, most pension funds in South Africa already invest a significant amount.
And one of the great ironies, yeah. Absolutely, one of the great ironies is a lot of these pension funds are actually looking outside of the country because there aren't really investable assets
in South Africa, yes. So I think, yes, we should be doing more, but the truth of the matter is that your average pension in South Africa already has a portfolio that is 30% fixed income. And that,
which is bonds, which is lending to corporates and lending to government.
And to government. So, yes, when people say lend more to government, it must be understood that pension funds are actually already doing that. So it's not as if they're not doing that.
Hand on your heart.
Yes.
Hand on your heart. What is your hand on your heart? Public sector pension safe?
Very much so. Very much so.
He's got his hand on his heart and everything. Abel Sithole. Thank you very much for coming in. It's really nice to see you again. Abel Sithole is the principal officer of the Government Employees Pension Fund. There's been some noise. There's been a couple of scuffles around it. In the bigger scheme of things, the money that is in question at the Public Investment Corporation isn't, as in percentage terms, that big. But you can't have a Wild West approach to investing. And it's your money and it's public sector money and this whole thing of prescribed assets. We need to investigate it further. But yeah, lots of sort of politicking around it. In reality, will it happen? I find it hard to see. But stranger things do have happened, of course, in South Africa.